how fast are we going there? And this comes from a time of tracking of progress by genome sequencing centers, where progress was very easily measured in, you know, number of bases covered. And CODE grew out of course, the sequencing of the human genome, and therefore they have a very similar approach to tracking progress, which I think is very healthy. But the challenge is that in the context of ENCODE, it's very difficult to track progress. And the traditional views were basically how many elements are we discovering, and the more elements, the better. But of course, we all understand that, you know, it's not as simple as that. That basically there's noise, and the more experiments you're going to do, the more noise you're going to have, and therefore the number of elements that you're going to be predicting in terms of peak calls or other things, it's simply going to go up linearly with the number of experiments that you do. There's the other problem, which is that some experiments, like RNA-seq, cover a much larger fraction of the genome than other experiments, like DNA, for example, or a TEF-ChIP-seq experiment. So there, you know, simply the number of nucleotides of the genome that are covered should not be our only metric of how well we're doing, and perhaps should not be a metric at all. And instead, there should be more of a, you know, formal information, theoretic kind of approach to understanding progress. And that's what this call is about. So basically, in the context of ENCODE 2, we had talked about this whole concept that, you know, the confidence with which an element is in fact measuring the genome and the, you know, rarity of that element in the genome should be directly proportionally related to the information content that we should assign to a position that is covered by those elements. In other words, if an element is, if a region of the genome shows RNA-seq, we're not going to be super surprised. If it shows, you know, a quiescent chromatin state, we're not going to be super surprised. If instead it shows some very rare chromatin state or some very rare element, then we should be surprised. And if that rare element is called with low confidence or with high confidence, it should immediately change the information assigned to that. So this was one approach that, you know, Mark and I and Ewan and Ian and others and Anshul and others in ENCODE were basically thinking about at the time in terms of having a formal prediction of information content of both different ENCODE experiments in terms of evaluating the value of different experiments, as well as evaluating the information content of a particular base of the genome, with which we can then point to interesting bases. There are two dimensions. I'm just going to, you know, through my notes. So basically, I talked briefly about one and two. The three and four are basically these different measures of progress. The first measure of progress is the genome dimension, which is something that we talked about primarily in terms of how many bases are we covering. The second dimension is the activity dimension. You can think of these as horizontal for the genome and vertical for the different cell types. And that's where measuring activity is actually related to predicting effectively what, you know, what is the pattern of activity of a particular element. And that can be predicted with high confidence if you do more and more cell types. So if you think of the challenge as finding all the elements and finding all their activity patterns, that challenge we get closer to by doing more experiments, but at some point this saturates and there's no more prediction of the activity pattern, there's no more improvement in the prediction of the activity pattern of an element because that activity pattern can be robustly inferred from, say, you know, 5 cell types or 10 cell types. And then you can basically say, if I do one more cell type, which is somewhat related to those, I expect that this element will belong in a class of elements that behave similarly, and therefore that I can predict its expression level in the next cell type. So this was number four, basically, and, you know, number three we talked about a little bit. Number five is measures of uniqueness and robustness that are based on imputation. In other words, when you're doing new experiments, you'd like to know that the, you know, information that you get from the experiment could not simply have been imputed. And that's where, you know, imputation-based measure come in, because you can basically say, if I could impute this, you know, this new experiment very well with existing experiments, then there's probably no point in doing the experiment. And somehow we'd like to know in advance. And there are measures that both Jason and I, Jason Ernst and I, have talked about for predicting how well, how much confidence do I have in my imputation. This is something that did not make the paper, but it's something that, you know, we've thought about a lot in terms of every time I make one of these predictions for an element in an imputation track, I can also predict the confidence with which I can make this prediction. And that confidence effectively tells me how much prioritization should I put in that type of experiment before I carry it out. In other words, if I can impute something and I'm very confident about that imputation, there's no point in doing the experiment. If I'm less confident about the imputation, then I can prioritize that particular experiment. So that's at the level of entire experiments. You can also use the agreement after you've done an experiment with the quote-unquote confident imputation of that experiment to basically say that if the experiment does not agree with a confident imputation, then I'm going to predict that that experiment is not good. So I'm going to downplay its importance in this sort of information-based measure. And that's still at the level of experiment, but after you've done the experiment. And then at the level of individual locations in the genome, if you have a highly informative experiment that agrees well with its imputation, for example, and has low coverage of the genome, but high confidence and high robustness in that coverage, then I can basically, you know, boost up the per nucleotide information content of that experiment. So that's basically all I had to say. I don't know if you guys want to weigh in on those comments or what you think. So Shipping, am I missing stuff? I mean, Anshul had sort of suggested talking about experimental design, and I think that's also very interesting to talk about, and it's sort of one of those meta issues that the DAC can play a role in. But I think these were sort of the things that I could think about. So I think the floor is open.
Yes, you summarize it really well. So exactly. I like, as I said yesterday, I really like the imputation-based measures. So are we going to have, say, three criteria, say, information content, the coverage, activity, or maybe four measures? We will compute four things simultaneously? Is that what you're suggesting we should do?
Yeah, so... I don't know if I've gotten to the practical part of what
okay.
I'm suggesting.
Okay. I mean, jumping ahead too much.
Yeah, we should eventually get there. We should sort mm-hmm. of conclude the call with a list of action items that
exactly.
we'd like to compute.
Uh-huh.
But I think at this point, before we go there, I'd love to just hear if I'm missing something altogether or whether, you know, this list makes sense with there's other issues. So, Joel, I don't know if this sort of agrees with the stuff that you guys have been thinking about and...
Yeah, I think what you said makes sense. I just have a couple comments. So just remembering back when we had this discussion for ENCODE 2, I remember I think Peter Beckel's group had some ideas about ways of doing the information theoretic calculations. Like,
and now I feel very stupid for not including Peter and Ben in this call. But anyway,
Joel, can you recall what they did? Do you have any documents?
I'm sure that we could go back and look at the AWG calls from ENCODE 2 because I strongly remember there being a presentation about this. But I'd have
I also know that every time you're on a phone call, you have expensive notes. So if you remember it, you probably have expensive notes.
actually, that's not true, but I could go back. I tend to remember things, but I could go back and look.
Yeah, can you go and dig it up?
Yeah, I could. I'll have a look and see if I can find it. The other thing I wanted to mention, not exactly with respect to the information content, but I think relevant to this, is if you remember, there was an analysis that Ian Dunham did as part of ENCODE 2.
Correct. I remember that.
We talked about like the saturation analysis for elements, but they also did this analysis where he looked at the breadth of cell lines, whether that was a representative coverage of all the available sort of, you know, human tissues and cell lines. And they did, a clustering analysis to see how well sampled the ENCODE2 cell lines sampled the space of all possible cell lines in the human organism.
Yeah, so Bowser recently did something like that.
Be useful.
Yeah, so Bowser recently did something like that, but one of the challenges that we have is that, you need sort of a larger space before you know if you cover it well. In other words, if you only cluster the existing ENCODE data sets, all it tells you is how they relate to each other. It doesn't tell you if you're missing, for example, you know.
Ian did at the time was he didn't just do on ENCODE2. What he did was he downloaded all like microarray expression data from ArrayExpress, and then he looked at where the ENCODE2 cell lines clustered with respect to all the available ArrayExpress data.
But basically, the only way to do that is to look at the subset of ENCODE that constitutes expression, basically.
Yes, because you don't have a bigger set. Well, I guess you could include all the roadmap data. But
yeah, so that's what Wouter did. So basically, Wouter clustered the roadmap data. But Wouter, you also looked at a lot more outside ENCODE and roadmap, right?
No, it was mainly roadmap comparing to a number of ENCODE samples, and then after that, what I did is I downloaded all current ENCODE data and tried to correlate all these samples with each other for each of the separate epitopes in case of ChIP-seq, but also for RNA-seq, etc. Then I also tried to combine all these correlation measures to sort of come up with like an overall scoring of similarity between cell types. The problem there, the main problem was that these data at that time were not uniformly processed. So one of the things we saw was probably a large like technical bias or lab specific signals and things like that. So it was very hard to draw any real conclusions from that, but at least, you know, one thing we got out of that is that we have a good overview of, you know, for each of the different assays, how much data is available for each cell type. But as for the actual data analysis, that remained a little bit tricky. I think the ENCODE DCC is now hard at work to make this uniform processing happen. They've set up their pipelines for it, and they're running everything on DNA Nexus. And so hopefully we'll get more information on that soon, and then we can try and repeat those things. And I think maybe someone else in the group has looked at all geo.
So I think Puya has downloaded all of geo. So Puya, can you give us an update of sort of where you are with all that?
I have not downloaded all of geo. I
did something. Maybe not all of geo.
Not that. No. I've done something kind of related, but not at all, trying to look at the different cell types. I'm looking at the opposite, right? I'm trying to see what cell lines we cover, but not. I'm not looking at the gene expression or anything like that.
So what are you looking at, and could someone leverage what you've done or something, like in terms of data comparisons or cell type?
No, I mean, I'm looking at the genotypes and SRA data. I don't think that really fits the same.
Sure.
Yeah, and only, you know, only the samples where the cell line is one that we've looked at or one that is known. So I think it's a bit outside the scope of this.
And you had actually done some imputations, but basically the problem there was that it was not the uniformly processed data. So, you know,
yeah,
I don't think that what you did is immediately useful, but maybe the code that you have written could be then reused to just re-impute things when you have, more data.
Yeah, but nonetheless, I found like the consistent peaks sample isolated cluster based on consistent peaks tend to make a meaningful pattern. For example, the EZH2 and the H3K27 trimethylation, they tend to cluster together using the consistent peaks, but not using the peaks that only observed in the real data.
Have a way to predict which peaks are more useful in a way, even at the peak level. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah. So essentially, like after imputation, you can call peaks on the imputed data and the observed data, right? And then you can compare the peaks and to see whether the peaks are consistent between the imputed data and the observed data, and use that as a metric, and then cluster the samples based on the consistency between the imputation and the observed data.
Basically,
so the pipeline and everything else is set up and. Yeah, I guess so. I was waiting for just the uniformly processed signals.
Yeah. Cool. So, Zhiping, you're sort of, in many ways our boss here in terms of what we should actually do. So, these are the activities that we've been involved in, and sort of, as you can hear, sort of several of them are pretty meaningless unless we have. The uniformly processed data.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, should we just have another call after we've had a chance to rerun these on the uniformly processed data?
You're talking about all the histomark, the ChIP-seq, you mean to uniformly process them between ENCODE 2 and ENCODE 3? Is that what you're saying?
Professor can give more details.
ENCODE 2, we have uniform processed data, I assume. It's just slightly different from ENCODE 3, new data.
Right, so for ENCODE 2, I think Anshu has done all the uniform processing of all the transcription factor ChIP-seq data, I believe. A lot of the data that's currently in the ENCODE repository, like additional data, is from different labs who are using different processing methods, and sometimes even report their signals on completely different scales, right? Like full chain.
Sure. But you're saying for the mouse ENCODE data, wasn't like things completely reprocessed?
Yeah. So they're now in the process of doing that, and I think actually last night, the ENCODE DC has finalized a bunch of P calls and signal tracks for mouse.
Okay.
And they're in the process of doing it for human as well. That's what I understood from Seth and Yuri from the DCC.
Right, with the ENCODE 3 pipelines. What I meant was when they were writing the mouse ENCODE paper, they reprocessed all the human ENCODE data up to that point. So So if we have a large enough set of uniformly processed data, we could calculate what we think should be calculated using that, right? At least get an idea to see whether or not the metrics we are using make sense. What I'm saying is, are we really hinged upon the processing of using the ENCODE 3 pipeline? Would that change our conclusion much?
So what you're saying is that it was cumulative, including all of ENCODE 3 up to that point. But my understanding was that it was just ENCODE 2 past the 2012 paper.
It was just ENCODE 2 past the 2012 paper.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but I'm just saying we have a big enough set, and the set is uniformly processed. So you wouldn't have the bias, like Walter was talking about, like the different assignments at the same position.
Yeah, but I think he also used all of the ENCODE 3 data.
Uh-huh.
Right, so Bowser, you looked at, I think the ENCODE 2 was basically just one-third of the data set, and ENCODE 3 was maybe two-thirds of the data set, right?
I'm not sure about that. It could well be the case. I think ENCODE 2, I think the number of cell types was fairly limited. So in order to get a good feel for, you know, when a raincoat has a good cell type coverage, it, you know, it's nice to have more cell types there. I don't know the exact percentages actually of raincoat 2 versus raincoat 3 for the analysis I did, but it's been a while.
Sorry, I have a question. For the uniformly processed, I think the peaks costs are uniformly processed, but for the big wig file, which is single nucleotide resolution, are not uniformly processed. Is that correct? Because when I check on the ANCO website, so for each sample, they will have a description how they call the peaks and how they process the big wig files. And some of them are not the same. Not all of them are the same. Some using a different peak callers. For example, some using Max or some using a peak call or some other type of software. So the signals are not actually uniformly processed. But the peaks actually, you know, the peaks are actually processed by Anshul, which is supposed to be...
I don't think that's correct. Anshul's pipeline outputs both the signal maps and the peaks as part of the uniform processing.
Yeah, I think the signal...
They should all be there, and they've processed... I mean, they were done, well, for ANCO 2 and for ANCO 3. There should be a set... analyzed using multiple peak callers. For ANCO 2, it was SPP and PeakSeq, and now it's SPP and the one from David Gifford's lab and PeakSeq. And there should be the output of the peak calls and the signal processing, I mean the signal maps, all done uniformly.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
But actually, a question I have, I don't know if Manolis or Zipping know the answer to this. So, obviously, Anshul did the uniform processing for ANCO 2, and we've set up the pipelines for ANCO 3, but the pipelines for ANCO 3 are not exactly the same as ANCO 2.
Mm-hmm.
Have the ANCO 2 data sets been reprocessed uniformly to match ANCO 3 pipelines?
I believe that's what the DCC is supposed to be doing.
But has that been completed yet?
I don't think so. I think they're still wrestling a little bit with the last bit of the TF ChipSeq pipeline from my conversation.
Patrick, could you follow up on the email that you have, I mean the email thread that you have with Seth, to basically ask him if they're actually also planning to reprocess all the code too?
Yeah, we'll do.
Okay.
That'll be great.
I mean, I agree with you, Jipping, but we should also make sure that they also think so.
Right. We just had this call yesterday. No, not with... Didn't we just talk about this yesterday with NHI and EDCAC?
We did, but still having it in written and...
Yeah, okay.
would basically help.
Right. So from the sheet we were talking about, it wasn't done. That's why Elise was saying, you know, what do you mean by not done? Are you going to release or are you still not done? Yeah. So what are we going to do then? It seems like this is a technical hurdle. But what about the plan? Can we have a plan once we have the uniform processed data available?
Yeah. That's exactly correct. So that's sort of the practical aspect of this phone call. So let's now switch, perhaps, to that. So, what would we like? We would like maybe for. I'm just going back through my bullet points of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So
mm-hmm.
2 is rarity plus confidence. So basically, to have some kind of information content for every ENCODE experiment where... And Wouter, I think, you know, with Epilogos, you're probably fairly set up to do something like that where you could apply the same metric that you have for chromatin state to different... you know, ENCODE type experiment. Is this something that you could do in terms of having an Epilogos score, basically, for, you know, each ENCODE experiment?
It's kind of a different approach, because what I use discrete chromatin state calls, right? It's very different from working with continuous signal tracks. But, you know, for calls, you know, for peak calls or DNA calls or something like that, I think it should be possible to come up with a way to adapt our current approaches to that.
Yeah, so two quick comments on that. I mean, the first is that when you have the signal intensity scores, I mean, we also have a p-value track that, you know, Anshul has really been advocating over the signal track, and that key value track should effectively be information content. So I'm less worried about capturing the height. And I think that for the peaks, I agree with you, that's the one that I was thinking about in terms of running your tool.
You're combining p-values across experiments. You're not necessarily doing anything with, this term keeps popping up. I don't really see why, but it's like you're not necessarily doing anything with information content or information theory, right?
Isn't that what Epilogos already does? By looking at the frequency of different signal tracks and, you know, their peaks, and by looking at the co-occurrence of them and, you know, the surprisal level.
I
think you're sort of understanding yourself in the sense that you are doing an information theoretic analysis. I mean, I don't think I'm overselling it. I think you're just simply, you know, maybe underselling it.
I don't know. It sounds to me like what you're trying to do is sort of, for every base pair in the genome, overlay all the p-value tracks and average them.
Average.
And get a sense of, you know, how dense of an information or how dense of a p-value strength you have at every base pair in the genome, right?
Yeah, but maybe also capture some kind of rarity, basically sort of weigh each of them. By, you know,
sure.
Like a replicate agreement measure, and sorry for such a dumb question, but Jipping, do we have replicates for all of the ENCODE experiments?
I thought we were supposed to have two replicates, biological replicates.
Joel, do you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's one of the requirements by NHGRI for any of the data producers. They have to do it in replicate.
Okay, so. Basically, agreement between replicates could be somehow encoded as, you know, what I'm calling robustness. And then genome coverage could be encoded as, you know, unique.
Some kind of surprisal, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And together, the rarity and the confidence could basically be used to provide a scaling factor for every experiment. And the p-value times that scaling factor is what I would like to add up. So, Wouter, I agree with your statement, but it's a scaled sum. It's a weighted average, where you're basically weighing things by the rarity and the agreement between replicates.
Well, yeah. So you're rating it by rarity and quality of the data, basically.
Exactly. Which I think is what, you know, information is all about. So if we had this, I think this would allow us to now go through the genome and basically say, here are the regions that are the most informative according to the bolus of ENCODE data, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that Mark?
This is Mark. I just joined. That's correct.
Hi, hey, Mark.
Sorry. Hi. So we have your group, my group, and Jimmy.
Oh, no one else made it? Okay.
No, but I mean, you know, the reason for inviting everybody was so that they're aware that this is happening. But yesterday when we agreed to talk, I mean, the goal is really to just talk.
I spoke with Bill earlier. He expressed regret for not being able to make it. He was very interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sure. No,
email,
that's fine.
He's saying that we should keep him informed in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark, Joel, very nicely pointed out that I'm very dumb for not inviting Peter Bickle and Ben to this call, but I think in future phone calls we should just remember to invite them both.
Yeah, no, they'll be interested. And I do think that, you know, having a, you know, nice statistical, I mean, I think there's a potentially a nice paper from this or a nice, ideas or things like that, but that's not to say what NHGRI wants, but, you know, obviously what we might want.
Yeah, I agree.
So let's recap for Mark. So what did you just say we were going to do? Take the comparison between replicates, Malolos, restate what you just said a minute ago.
Oh, yeah. So basically, I was saying that, so for number two, on my list that, you know, the p-value of different experiments, chip-seq experiment, the p-value that you get for every position of the genome could then be scaled by both the rarity of that experiment and the confidence, which is sort of a measure of the agreement between replicates, to provide some kind of information per base for that element of the genome. And then you could just sum up all of that across all of the encoded experiments. Basically, get at a surprising level or at a level of information per base for every experiment in ENCODE. And then that amount of information is effectively the progress that ENCODE is making in terms of annotating the genome, which is sort of summing that up over the genome and basically figuring out what fraction of the genome is associated with what level of information.
But, I'm sorry, the only thing I'm missing, I'm sure you discussed this, but there's, of course, the key issue of the correlation between this experiment. How is that taken into account?
You mean the correlation between replicates?
Well, no, the correlation between two
different
experiments. I mean, it's
different TFs.
Two different experiments.
Yeah, so that's number five, basically, the imputation-based measures, where for imputation, you can basically have a confidence in your imputation, where you basically, prior to even observing the data, you can say, here's how confident I am that I can impute this data set well. And then that confidence tells you both about the prioritization of the experiment and about the correlation of that experiment with other experiments. So number five could also be a scaling factor of, if I can impute that experiment very well, then that, the information content of that experiment gets decreased, which is one way to capture the correlation, basically. I mean, there are other ways of capturing the correlation, which is simply, correlation.
This is
Walter. I just heard back from Anshul about the pipeline, and the plan is to also reprocess all the ENCODE 2 data.
Okay, fabulous. Thanks for providing that answer. Go ahead, Mark.
One thing I was going to say is, I completely agree with you. The trick, there's a few bits of trickiness, obviously, to this. One, of course, is that, obviously, there's also the quality of the experiment. Clearly, if you have an experiment that, let's just say that you predict an experiment, it looks like very much like another experiment, but then actually the experiment gives very different results from what you expect, but it's because you screwed up the experiment completely. Now, you don't want to give that a very high information content,
yeah,
right?
No, of course. Basically, we talked about three measures for the imputation. The first is at the experiment level, before you even do the experiment, of how well you predict that you can impute it. The second one is the agreement. Once you have imputed it, if you are pretty confident that you can impute it well, and yet the experiment does not agree with what you're imputing, then you can use that to downweigh that experiment as a poor quality experiment, even if the replicates agree between each other. And then the third one is on a per position base of how well that experiment, once you have this global metric, so you can then go to the local level and then say, if I have a high accuracy predictor and this particular peak does not correlate well or does not agree with my prediction, then I can, at the nucleotide level, then downweigh my excitement about that particular peak.
Hey, guys, I just want to say I'm here. My name is Bill.
Other
meeting is early.
Oh, hey, Bill.
Is it Bill Noble?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Because when you say my name is Bill, I'm like,
we know
one Bill.
I just misspoke, right?
Hi, Bill. My name's Manoli.
Hi, Manoli. Nice to meet you.
Okay, fabulous. So thanks for joining, Bill. We're not going to re-summarize. I actually asked the shipping to record this conversation, so we will have a recording of the first half.
Mm-hmm.
So, we can always end it.
My difficulty is I have to leave at 4:55 for kids pickup.
Okay, so we have another 10 minutes.
Basically. Yeah.
Well, let me just, this is Mark. Let me just say, here's the bottom line. I'm really interested in what you're saying, and I expect, Bill, just sort of, we're talking a lot about, you know, information theoretic measures of the additional information in each experiment. I'm very interested in that. But what I'm also interested in, and I think we have to strive for, is I think what NHGRI wants, and also which I think is interesting intellectually to think about, is how to... It's a little abstract, and I think people want a somewhat simplified view of this. And I just think, like, the number of added bits per experiment, if it can be described in terms of some slightly simpler idea that, well, we've found this many new sites, or we've determined activity, new or non-trivial activities on this many things that we already knew were there, or, you know, some way of describing that, that then one can chart, you know, I'm saying in sort of simple terms.
Yeah, I agree completely with you, Mark. So let me say two things. I mean, number one, which basically I'm agreeing completely, but I'm just rephrasing slightly. So number one, we do want that information metric, and I think we do want to spend the time to explain it to people. But at the same time, we want to compute some additional metrics that perhaps might be based on the information metric. They're much easier to handle rather than just saying we learned, you know, 1.2 million bits of information from this experiment. We basically also tell them, and this corresponds to that many peaks called with this confidence and that fraction of the genome and stuff like that. So basically some more tangible metrics. Basically, I think, you know, people will be very receptive to an information measure where you can sort of track the total information content across experiments, and you know, you can sort of tell how it's progressing with time, and you can tell about how different types of experiments are contributing to it, and all of that is fine. The moment you look at relative measures between experiments, information is a fine metric. But if you're looking at some kind of intuition with an absolute measure that people can, you know, write home about, then we should also translate that into metrics that might be less rigorous but more tangible. So I agree with those two components. I hope that's what you meant.
Oh, okay, no, that sounds good.
Okay, fabulous. So we were actually fairly concrete in terms of what we'd like to measure. The problem is that there's some scaling factors that are fairly arbitrary. Like, how do you take the agreement between replicates, and how do you scale that with the agreement to imputation, and how do you scale that with, you know, the fraction of the genome that's covered, and, you know, all of that, and how do you scale that to the p-value of the p? I mean, there's, like, four lambdas in there that I can imagine, and as much as we want to keep this information grounded, at some point it's going to have to be practical, and we're going to have to combine things, we're going to have to come up with a single metric, and for this we're going to need some lambdas, and I think I'm comfortable with that. I don't know if you guys are comfortable with that.
Well, every model has parameters, of course. Yeah, I think I'm comfortable with it.
So, I mean, again, Bill, I think you're sort of one of the most sort of, you know, information theory savvy folks here, so maybe you'll be able to save us from too many parameters by saying, hey, this is the correct way of doing this. But right now, in terms of practicality, we're going to come up with some very detailed proposal as a straw man, but then that's the place where I'd love to sort of hear feedback from everyone as to, you know, here's the correct way of implementing that. So my goal is to sort of work with Yue and Wouter and Puya in my group to come up with such a proposal as a straw man, mm-hmm. and then circulate it to this group,
mm-hmm.
and effectively get feedback as to, you know, whether this makes sense. And then once we have a proposal, we can basically choose how to implement it. That's something where, you know, we could take the lead, or Mark could take the lead, or you know, someone of us.
Can you guys, so Joel was talking about, like, Peter Bickel's previous, and, like, Ian Dunham's previous approaches?
Yeah.
Yeah, can you guys take a look at it? Or maybe Joel, can you share that beforehand, before the straw man?
Yeah, Joel, if you take it out, could you please resend it to this list and also include Peter and Ben?
Sure, I'll do that.
Okay, fabulous. Yeah.
And then that would be really good if we can have a straw man and then go over it and, go from there.
Yeah. And then something that was not captured in the previous conversation was number 4 in this list. Basically, I think everything that was captured previously was pertaining to number 3. Number 4 has this whole concept of determining the activity of an element, not just the presence and the confidence in that element.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of for self-specific elements, this is, you know, what will dominate effectively. Because, you know, when you do an experiment, you don't just want to discover new elements. You also want to refine your understanding of the activity pattern of existing elements. So I made a fairly detailed proposal at the beginning of the call. This will be part of both the recording and the summary that we're going to write. But very briefly, the way that we think about this is these enhancer modules that Sauter is discovering, for example, and the fact that with partial data of, you know, a subset of the cell types, we still predict the module fairly well, and that allows you to now get an understanding of the mode or the, you know, archetype or the eigenvector or something of activity for each element. And based on that, you can basically say these new experiments are helping me refine that assignment of an element to an activity class, and also be able to saturate rather than just say we need to do every freaking cell type on the planet. You can say, you know, we have 120 cell types already. That gives us an assignment of every element into an activity class. With another 100 cell types, we will be able to refine these classes somewhat, but that the gross assignments are going to remain there, and that there is saturation rather than we need to keep doing more and more cell types. Does that make sense to everybody?
No, I like this. I mean, in sort of, if you do an experiment and it essentially gives you a result that's far from the kind of eigenvector prediction, if I get this right, you would then give it a lot of information weight. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's slightly different than that. I was thinking about it slightly differently, in a sense that you basically can cluster elements and
mm-hmm,
say
mm-hmm.
These are immune elements, and
yeah.
These are immune plus brain elements. And when you do an additional cell type like liver,
mm-hmm.
You might find that this experiment is now also active in liver, and that liver was not well represented in your previous set of, eigenvectors. And I think that's what you were getting at when you were saying, you know, it doesn't fit well with your eigenvectors because you've now expanded the eigenvectors. So, you can basically quantify the information or the informativeness of different experiments based on how well they allow you to refine these eigenvectors. And, you know, most experiments will continue to agree with your prediction, but others will actually expand the dimensionality of your, vector set. Does that make sense?
So maybe as a result, you need another eigenvector.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly. Basically, it sort of not only changes your weight. You know,
mm-hmm.
some experiments will sort of change your weight,
mm-hmm.
and other experiments will simply add dimensionality, add vectors.
Right. Well, I think we really need to spell this out very carefully in order to be able to explain to the ENCODE production PIs.
I think the thing that I just want to amplify again, the thing that maybe Bill wants to amplify or someone wants to amplify on this is that the thing that I'm quite interested in this, and I really like the idea. You know, I sort of have two goals that I think would be nice, and they're very different goals. I mean, one goal is I really think it would be nice to write a paper. And we had this idea actually originally in ENCODE 2, in a sense, to, you know, have some very nice, information theoretic ideas on, you know, quite proper statistics and everything like that of, you know, how much, you know, information does, you know, one TF site give you, or how much new information does one additional experiment give you, and really talk about the genome annotation process in terms of the secreting information. I think that's one goal. I think another goal, like I said, is to make these pictures for NHGRI, and also I think we must realize, quite importantly for the experimental PIs, who, they feel very passionately, you know, in a good way about each experiment, all their experiments providing information. So, for instance, when this was discussed earlier, some of the PIs, for instance, they would say, you know, here's a good, what came up all the time is, oh, you know, you do STAT1 or something like that, and then you do that with, I think, a particular additional chemical added or something like that, and the binding site slightly change, you know, or like one peak disappears or something like that. And, you know, a lot of the, you know, from a purely information theoretic perspective, very little information is gained in doing that. But, you know, a lot of the PIs will argue very strenuously that, you know, that experiment is still very worthwhile doing. You've learned a lot. You can't tell me that that experiment is, you know, not.
Yeah, they may say being agree with what you expect is also very informative.
No, I know. So I think it's important to me. I mean, I think what NHGRI wants, I mean, which is a little, I mean, I think we want to do something interesting. I mean, I think part of what we want to do is do something interesting statistically, and that's kind of very rigorous and so forth.
Yeah.
But I do think that if our job, in a sense, is to also do something that NHGRI can present on calls, and most of the people on the calls are not going to be us. And most of the people on these calls will be, you know, the John Stams and whatnots of the world, and who are going to, you know, have very, you know, fairly strong views if we start to say this experiment or that experiment, it has more or less information. I mean, they're actually going to pipe up quite strongly on that. And
the
I think
only
we,
thing that saves us is that I think DNAs will fare well, so.
Well, fair enough. But that's exactly the issue. You know, that's actually quite interesting because that, you know, and I think we have to be able to boil it down to simple terms. And also, I think we have to think, you know, I think what NHGRI wants is, I mean, even though they're, I think, happy to let us do interesting statistics and so forth, I think that's not per se what they, you know, what they want. I mean, they, like, so they want to present little progress charts to basically the ECP or whatever they call it.
But I think in their defense, if we write something interesting that's clear that we manage to convey well, they'll be receptive to it.
Yeah.
I think what they want, what they don't want is like a big theoretical rant about what the correct way to do it that would be impossible to implement.
Mm-hmm.
What they will be receptive to is if that rant comes accompanied with, and here's a practical implementation where we made these simplifying assumptions, and here's an answer that you can actually plot.
Right.
No, that's fine. I'm just making, you know what I'm saying. I'm just sort of emphasizing that.
There should be a practical component that's like digestible and reusable by NHGRI staff and understandable by them. So,
well, and also I would go farther and say defendable in very clear terms to to more experimental people. And let me just say one last thing. The reason, okay, so my recollection, maybe Joel remembers better than I do, or you guys remember better than I do, but the reason that actually all that discussion we had in ENCO 2 with Peter Vickel and Ewan and on never actually made it. It didn't make it into the paper, right? It never made it, and it never got used, right? So I think the reason it never really got used was that it never got to a satisfactory point where I think that it was never something that really was that palatable to the more experimental people. That was my sense of why it foundered, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. So we should basically stay aware of the fact that we not only need to be digestible by the computational information crowd and, you know, rigorous enough to be not laughed at by them, but at the same time, biological enough that the PIs will embrace it.
Yeah, and I think that's, honestly, I really think, like, I think NHGRI wants something from us that they're going to show to the PIs. I mean, that's what they want, and that's, you know, whatever.
Okay, fabulous. So we're at the end of the time, and I think we have a way forward, which is my lab will produce a very concrete straw man, and then we'll circulate it, and then we'll get feedback from everybody. We'll decide on what we actually want, and then we'll move forward with implementation by, you know, folks across our lab.
Sounds good.
Does that make sense? Sounds really interesting.
Sounds really good.
Yeah. Okay, superb. So timeline-wise...
Last thing I would say, I think we should have another call with more lead time, maybe, after you choose a straw man. We should try to get Rafa and Peter, you know, really, and have a more, you know, because we do have a lot
guys,
of people that know about this.
Do you guys want to do 4 p.m. next Friday?
I don't think I can make that. Well, you can just continue on, but I don't know if I'll make it. But
what about 11 a.m. next time? Next
on
Friday?
The DAC. Yeah, I can do that. I can do that on the DAC.
Does 11 a.m. work?
11
a.m.
is a 3D nuclear call.
No, that's 11 a.m. your time. He means 11 a.m. Eastern time.
8 a.m. your time.
Okay. I'm actually
okay, fabulous. I'm setting it up in my calendar. So June 5, 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern.
Okay, why don't you email that? I'm not entirely sure. I have to check.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. So, sorry, will people be there?
I won't. Bill, I won't be there. I'm going to be traveling.
Well, yeah, maybe you know, how about this? Why don't you email Ramiro? So maybe you want, I mean, it sort of depends on how much time it's going to take you guys to put together a proper proposal. Maybe you want to, I'll leave it up to you how you want it.
Yeah, just give it a little bit of lead time.
Yeah, but what I'm suggesting is sort of setting up the call now, and then, you know, even before we have the proposal.
Yeah, June 5th, next Friday, I can make 11 a.m. I just look.
Okay, but Bill, you cannot?
No, but I could do any other Friday, I mean the 12th or the 19th.
Okay, let me look at the 12th.
Yeah, I can't do those either. But don't worry. Just you worry about this, Melissa. You just move ahead. You're going to get into scheduling.
Yeah. Okay. I gotta go also. Sorry, I have to go for kids' reasons.
The doodle poll, or you guys could all send me some times that you can actually make.
Okay.
And then I could, you know, why don't I set a few dates, and then once we know.